Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Students around the world are asking questions about God, the truth, and the meaning of their lives. Your gift will put top-notch Catholic intellectuals in front of students who are seeking. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students to transform a student's life today. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students.
The role of positive human law according to Aquinas. Now, the relationship between the moral order and the penal order of the state is an issue that in many countries is generating conflicts. Quarrels about this become red hot when the political legal reaction to abortion is discussed, and when strange ideological positions are being thrusted upon society. In many countries today, it's no longer a debate whether abortion is to be made legally permissible, but whether the already present legal availability of abortion may be restricted, and if so, to what extent. Does the eventual move to change an existing political and legal compromise that leaves abortion unpunished in some cases is the object of dispute? Furthermore, it becomes clear that some political maneuvers are not always pure. There are politicians who bring up the issue of abortion so as to divide the electorate, and then they use the heated debate as a cover-up for their other doings that are immoral and corrupt. In such situations, one often has the impression, maybe not necessarily so in the USA, but certainly in my country, in Poland, that in the minds of vociferous Catholics and many representatives of the clergy, the only socially relevant moral issue that they see is that of abortion and other dubious procedures discussed in bioethics, which they want to be made illegal and penalized, whereas other social evils, like the taking over of the public media by one party, so as to further mendacity, slander, and calumnies, provoking quarrels in families and in society, the corrupt siphoning of taxpayers' money to private hands, the breaking into the telephones of opposition figures and their unjustified arrest, the bypassing of the constitutional order through the abolition of the rule of law and the division of powers, so as to impose an authoritarian regime. These are socially disruptive moral evils that do not meet with any response from the Catholic side. Furthermore, the focusing of the chief energy on the hoped-for total penalization of abortion gives the impression that some Catholics, and unfortunately also some members of the clergy, seem not to really believe in the power of grace. Their prime intent is the changing of the penal law of the state through a reference to the natural law, whereas belief in the role of the new law of grace and of the sacraments and the ensuring of a pastoral formation that would contribute to growth in charity and chastity and other social virtues in society seems to be weak. Those who have such a frame of mind are then speechless when what happened some time ago in Poland, government officials sent by the ruling party, acting supposedly in the name of Catholic values and the defense of life, stole medical records of women who have had an abortion so as to then blackmail them, and also sent police agents to a clinic, interrupting the interview with a patient who has had a miscarriage, thus denying the privacy of medical care. Is this how human life is to be defended? It's not surprising that such politically motivated executive actions have provoked a backlash with an increasing demand for the extension of the availability of abortion. The reflections of Aquinas on the human law, even though they were written centuries ago, bring a refreshing light to such problems. It has to be, of course, remembered that what Aquinas wrote about the human law is set within a wider perspective of the history of salvation, and so the presentation is theological and also metaphysical. According to our Dominican master, in the center of Christian morality lies not sin that has to be condemned, not the moral law that has to be justified, not moral cases that have to be resolved, not a social moral order that has to be imposed through political maneuvers, but in the center there is the grace of Christ that enables individuals to live a life of virtue, that is, to creatively and consistently choose the true good, coming thereby step by step closer towards supreme beatitude. The preaching of this fundamental truth was Aquinas's main concern as he worked out his moral theology. Thus he held that the supreme dignity needs to be attributed to those who are led towards the good, not by others, but by themselves, from their own interiority, transformed from within by grace. Aquinas's pertinent comments on the human law were located within a theological vision of man and the world that is not common today. Contemporary society does at times refer to a moral order, but to one that is not grounded in eternal metaphysics, the natural law, and the history of salvation. Today's moral order in Western societies is primarily a social imaginary that basically approves a few moral principles, human rights, democratic procedures, a market economy, and respect for public opinion. These values carried by society are, however, subject to change and manipulation by ideologies. They are intrinsically secular, located in the present known time and not grounded in eternity. And even those of us who look towards eternity and stress that the current social and moral order is to be under guard, we recognize that the moral order that underlies our modern societies and the sense of what is generally deemed natural, meaning obvious, owe more to Grotius and Locke than to Aquinas. Nevertheless, we may courageously look into the argumentation of Aquinas. His atemporal reflection throws a light that is deeper than the current social imaginary, and his reference to fundamental eternal principles is still applicable to contemporary problems. This does not mean that in reading Aquinas, we can completely ignore his historical background and the social setting of his doctrine. In the Middle Ages, the relationship between the church and the state, with its Christianitas, a Christian social order and ideology, was different than ours. Father Thomas Gilby, a commentator of Aquinas's treatise on law and its understanding of the state, observed, quote, "So far as the church and the state could be separated in the 13th century, the church was the older legal and political body of the two, and in some ways more powerful, by its titles in history, apart from the claims of religion, by jus humanum, apart from jus divinum. It stood like a trustee over secular authority, a guarantor of its rule, so long as the government kept its promises, a guardian of customary liberty, an arbiter in disputes, and a kind of universal and effective ombudsman." The treatise on law in Aquinas does imply this state of affairs, but it does not claim that in human law the rights of the spiritual power are superior to those of the temporal power, as though it were like imperial to proconsular authority, or hold that canon law or church authorities could suspend the operations of civil law or depose a civil ruler. There is no reason to suppose that St. Thomas would have supported the claims of Boniface VIII to sovereign dominion, but rather the contrary. End of quote. These, however, are guesses about the taken-for-granted political perceptions of Aquinas derived from his doctrine. His writings are completely free of any reference to the current political dilemmas of his time. This distance allows us to reach to his principles and perceive their ahistorical value. According to Aquinas, all positive human laws, and in consequence all states, have their dignity, their specific autonomy, and their limitations, as they do not reach the supreme ethical level of the law of the gospel. So, the dignity of positive human law. Aquinas went beyond the teaching of Saint Augustine and reached out to Aristotle, treating the institutions of political life as an achievement of the social nature of man, rather than as restrictions imposed upon him as a result of his sinful and destructive capacities. Man is sinful, but it is not because of this that the state exists. In an age which was not delicate in punishing, Aquinas focused upon the potestas directiva, the directive power of positive law, attributing to it a higher role than that of the potestas coactiva, the coactive force. Human law, above all, is a necessary aid in social life, structuring the way how decisions are arrived at and implemented within the social fabric, and not only a threat that withholds malefactors. Like all types of law, in accord with Aquinas's general definition of law, lex est rationis ordinatio ad bonum commune, human law is to order the reason of all moral subjects towards the common good. It has primarily a pedagogical, sapiential function. The fact that in social life there are authorities, with the distinction between the governing and the governed, as also there are inequalities in wealth and influence, is of divine intent. Just as God created ants and bees that live together with a diversity of functions, so also he created human nature that is social. Man needs support and security that are supplied by social bonds and state institutions. These needs are written into human nature from its beginnings, irrespective of the complications caused by the fall of the first parents and later historical events. The state that has to adapt to the realities of humanity marked by sin and struggling with it, in itself, is from nature, and not from sin, nor is it from violence or theft of those who are in power, or from a social contract worked out in the name of utilitarian convenience, even though such events may have taken place, because in essence the finality of the state is deeper. Being natural, that is, in accord with the divine creation of man as a rational and social animal, it has a necessary function and force, making its regulations and laws morally binding. The human mind is capable of discerning order and finality in the world and in basic human inclinations, and this fundamental order precedes all legislation. It can be interpreted as an echo of the Creator's project. Being metaphysical rather than psychological or social, present within nature, when it is recognized by human thought, this order becomes a moral law. Nature is a teacher that shows what is appropriate and what is only an apparent good. Thus, the laws that are enacted by the state with their practical dispositions have their ultimate source in the natural law, from which they derive their deepest justification and authority. If laws that are passed by kings, dictators, or parliaments are in some respect in discord with the natural law, they do not merit to be called laws, and in fact they are a scandalous perversion of law. When the state law is contrary to the natural law, it imposes upon its citizens a disintegrating moral dilemma. Nature then requires something different than the state law. Such dilemmas wound human interiority and cut down respect for the state and its laws. It is essential, therefore, that the state in its legislation will take into account human nature and its fundamental requirements. Positive human law has a specific end, necessary for the state, even though it is narrower in its finality than that of revealed divine law, which leads to eternal beatitude with God. Human laws are to ensure social peace and promote virtue and friendship, and so they punish evil acts that destroy the peace. Laws enacted by the state are to be focused upon what is good for the people. For many individuals, they are a preliminary sign pointing to the moral law that they fail to perceive, or they grasp it only in a hazy way. Human laws cannot enforce goodness upon citizens, but they strive towards it. In this, the possibilities of human law are limited. Goodness derives from virtue, and so to be true, it must flow from the interiority, from man himself. The law, however, may guide towards goodness through its educative discipline. This is an important function of state law that attributes dignity to it, irrespective of whether the authority that is enacting the laws is lawful according to social custom and the tradition of a given society or not. People cannot live in anarchy. They need signposts that show what is good. They need a social order that allows them to plan their lives and gives them a sense of security. Even a dictator who has taken over power in an informal way, when he issues laws that serve social peace, such as traffic regulation or rules about ecology, since this is done in accord with the principles of natural law, he is to be obeyed. And in this, he's acting well and deserves respect. Aquinas's reflection reached to the deepest underlying reasons of the legal order without entering into dynastic, ideological, or even mythical arguments sometimes claimed by kings who would thus justify their position and power. For him, it was sufficient to recognize that since political authority serves a natural social need, on the deepest level, it derives from God. If it is not evidently evil and fulfills the basic function of leading towards goodness and the defense of peace and the social order, it deserves respect. Furthermore, following the Greek conviction about the political nature of man led Aquinas to the conclusion that we really, and not only apparently, belong to the temporal city. Our existence in time and within a given society is not just an occasional stage of a pilgrimage to eternity, or only a circumstance of sanctification that supposedly in fact is taking place elsewhere. It has a true value here and now. It is the space for real life and virtuous action. Thus, states and their laws, being parts of this world, are needed and are a worthy part of it. Even as the kingdom of Jesus is not of this world, it takes place partly in this world, a world that God loves. And as such, this world has its own needs and institutions and laws deriving from the laws of nature. But the state has no right to interfere in the spiritual dimension of human existence. It does not have totalitarian power. This is because the heart of man and everything that he is and may be is to be ordained towards God. The relative autonomy of human law. Human law, even though it derives from the natural moral law, it is not its simple Xerox copy. It has to take into account additional factors and diverse circumstances that are specific in the given society which it has to serve. This gives room for the inventiveness of politicians and legislators who may have varying and conflicting views about these specific circumstances and about ways of dealing with needs resulting from their diverse experience. Aquinas' argumentation is based upon the distinction between scientia and ars. First, he affirms the basic thesis that human law, if it is not to be a corruption of law, has to be based on the foundation of natural law. Conclusions from the natural law may be drawn in two ways: from premises, as is done in the a priori sciences, granting thereby knowledge, or through the formulation of practical judgments and the applying of principles, as is done by the arts. In the second mode, Aquinas gives the example of an architect who applies the basic principles of his art to the practical dimensions of a given house. We can also give the example of a physician who makes a diagnosis and decides about a specific cure, or an artist who is creating his work gives a unique form to it. The architect or doctor must know the principles of his art. He has to have knowledge about the theory of construction or medical science. But in his final decision, a great role is played by experience, sense, invention, sometimes even dash and risk. In this process of decision-making, an important role is played by prudence that forms the free choice and enables the creative transition from intention, sometimes deliberation, to decision and execution. The free choice that involves the reason and the will in their mutual interplay and influence, in its three or four stages, is subsequent to the light of the conscience, that is the initial act of the practical reason illuminated by moral law. And after the choice has been made and the act has been executed, it is subject to a subsequent evaluation of the conscience. Furthermore, in the case of a Christian, this process is also formed by faith and charity. Thus, from the first principle of the natural law, that is the synderesis, which states that good is to be pursued and evil is to be avoided, and from an appreciation of the metaphysical inclinations inscribed in human nature, a more particular ethical conclusion is drawn. For example, that the innocent are not to be killed. Such a theoretical conclusion pertains to the science of ethics. If it has been drawn in a correct way, it is unshakable and unchangeable. However, as in the process of legislation, a practical application of the conclusion of the natural law is made, specifying that in a given state, the killing of the innocent will be punished in a declared and not in another way, or even in some cases hardly punished, this is done in the mode of art. The formulation of human laws and their enactment by legislative bodies pertains to the art of politics. Conclusions that pertain to ethical science even as they applied to positive human law, draw their force from the principles of the natural law, being as if its extension. Whereas practical specifications of positive human law, being an expression of political or legal art, have their binding force from the human law itself. Thus, many practical rulings and judgments of the human law are only relative, subject to an eventual correction, a new application in changed social circumstances, and with the arrival of new moral sensibilities. But on the level of ethical principles that ground the human law, such relativistic variability is unthinkable. The relative character of human law does not mean that it is autonomous in its axiology. Human law, to be law, must be rooted in the values shown by natural law. But the legislator may search for novel legal and political solutions, taking into account the specifics of his society. This grants to politics a particular space and autonomy in respect to ethics and theology, meaning that politicians and legislators should not be constantly pestered through hypercritical moralization. A politician is to be judged not uniquely on the basis of his unflinching and maybe obstinate adherence to ethical principles, but also according to his competence and cleverness, his capacity to foresee the consequences of his steps, his knowledge of social problems, and his skill in negotiating necessary compromises that serve the calming of social tension. Integrity and moral honesty in a politician are, of course, of great value. But parliamentarian struggles and negotiations require also something more. The politician needs to be led by a specific species of prudence, called prudentia regnativa, as he is often faced with the challenge of not only distinguishing goodness from evil, but with the dilemma of choice among multiple options and their reasons. Many issues are resolved not only through knowledge of the ethical principles, but also through the knowledge of society, diplomatic tact, the ability of attaining compromise, and political talent. Thus, not every error of a politician is a betrayal of the science of ethical principles. His error may turn out to be only an error in political art. It may have serious consequences for which the politician bears responsibility, but it cannot be immediately deduced that in his political decisions, he's failing to refer to ethical principles. Theological and ethical reflection on the one side and the practical undertaking of political decisions on the other are two distinct spheres of human thinking and acting, having their own specific range resulting from the two functions of the human mind. Theology supplies to law and politics an external measure as to what may or may not be done in the light of the eternal end of man. But it does not supply the politician with information about his own field of activity, nor does it dictate methods. Thus, the state, according to Aquinas, has its own dignity and autonomy in respect to theological ethical thought, which doesn't mean an ethical laissez-faire. This is something that the Second Vatican Council has taught, insisting upon the independence and autonomy of the political community in respect to the Church, and also upon the right and duty of the Church to pass moral judgment in matters of the public order when the fundamental rights of the person or the salvation of souls require it. Thus, commenting on the teaching of Aquinas, Father Gilby noted, again I'm quoting him, "He who would have rejected the dichotomy between private religion and the morality on the one hand, and public and a morally neutral service on the other, because it represented not merely a withdrawal of the church from its proper scene, but also a surrender of the ethical dignity of the state, end of quote. The autonomy of the political realm in respect to the moral order is therefore not absolute, but relative. Now, the limited scope of human law. The relative autonomy of human law in respect to ethical issues derives from the fact that the state does not permeate human issues as deeply as God does, who grants believers a law that is written in their hearts and is supported by grace. Thus, the state does not register people in the city of God or ban from it, nor does it require a religious conversion. In Aquinas' understanding, the human law has a limited function. For the state, it is sufficient that man makes the first steps towards virtue, and the further stages of spiritual and moral growth are a matter of other educative forces in society and the church, and not of the state. Christians, therefore, have to have greater confidence in the word of God and the power of grace than in that of the state in leading people to moral perfection. The state does not punish every committed sin. Aquinas had no doubts about this. The introduction of a universal penalization of sins would provoke more evil than good. And that is why the state, just as God himself, tolerates the fact that evil often remains for a long time unpunished. This by no means entails an approval of evil. It is precisely because the state is incapable of punishing all evil, and yet it is necessary that evil be condemned, that God gave us a revealed law. The limited possibility of the state in leading men to goodness, intended by God in the eternal law, is one of the arguments explaining the necessity of a revealed law. This means that the state has to focus on an ethical level that is proportioned to the average life of the citizen, which is always distant from the full ethos of the gospel. Thus, quoting St. Augustine, Aquinas mentioned, although maybe without great conviction, the case of state permission of prostitution that gives an outlet to disordered sexual desires, which otherwise could provoke worse evils. Furthermore, the state may desire, a society may desire, and the state may approve a sphere of privacy in which the state does not intervene, even privacy to commit sins. But at the same time, the state of disapproval of evils has a positive pedagogical function, and the depenalization of evils has a deleterious effect. Thus, the political decision about the state's reaction towards sinful acts is by no means simple. Some evil acts will always remain unpenalized by the state. Therefore, in society, rather than just prevention of evil, there should be also the promotion of goodness, which may be undertaken by various social forces, including the church. There remains, therefore, a difficult problem. Which sins ought to be punished by the state, and which sins the state may tolerate? Because the introduction of their penalization would cause greater damage. Aquinas at various occasions gave examples of sins that are left unpunished by the state. Is this in principle a closed list, or is it closed due to the limited technical capacities of medieval states and the possible social consequences of penalization of those times? Or even is it closed due to Aquinas' imagination as to what would be possible in societies known by him? That is, in different social conditions, would he extend or limit the list of sins that are to be left unpunished by the state? To answer this question today, following the mind of Aquinas, we have to look into the principles that are underlying his explanation. One is tempted, however, to suspect that the sins that he mentioned as being tolerated by the state were indicated by him because they were typical and universal shortcomings that he met among people of his own background in southern Italy, which suggests that in other times and in different societies, state's toleration of evil may be worked out differently. Aquinas declared that the law does not punish usury, because for many people it is handy, even though it is morally dubious. Similarly, knowing the customs of this society, Aquinas did not require the penalization of fornication. Human law needs a social support. If such is lacking, because there are not enough virtuous people, then the law refrains from punishing a given evil act. Also, when a trader misleads a client about the true value of his merchandise, this is dishonesty, but the law does not have the means to punish it. Aquinas therefore accepts such a tolerance of evil by the state. These examples are justified by common sense, which does not expect too much from the state. What are the binding principles in the determination of the extent of the penalization of evil? Two articles, the second and the third of question 96 of the Prima Secunda, deal with this problem. Aquinas begins with a reference to the wise principle of Saint Isidore of Seville, who declared that the law has to be possible, both according to the nature of the issue and in the light of social customs. It is obvious that not all people are virtuous, and so not all are capable of accepting too difficult requirements. Thus the human law does not forbid all sins that the virtuous avoid. It only forbids those sins that the major part of society is capable of avoiding, and those that are particularly obnoxious towards others, because without such a prohibition, society cannot be preserved. As an example, Aquinas mentioned murder and theft. The principle that is formulated here following Saint Isidore's comment focuses both on the objective structure of evil acts that corrupt social life and on the social resonance of an eventual penalization. To ascertain the first reason, one has to know well the principle of ethics, knowing exactly in what the given evil consists and how it affects the life of the community. Without a good orientation in moral principles, there cannot be good legislation. But to ascertain the second reason, the reaction of people to an eventual penalization, one has to know one's own society and know what it is capable of. The first question is the domain of scientia, ethical knowledge, whereas the second, even though it may base itself upon the results of the science of sociology, is the domain of political arts. It is only the tying of both perspectives that allows for the wise decisions of legislators. The aptness of this principle is obvious. Aquinas knew that the state may lead people to virtue only gradually, step by step, and so one should not impose too demanding requirements through the power of the state upon a society that is immature. Aquinas quoted here the words of Jesus as he compared the new and old economies of salvation. Requirements pertaining to the perfect life should not be imposed from without upon imperfect people, just as new wine is not to be poured into old wineskins. Such a procedure would generate opposition and an internal rebellion, breaking individuals who are not sufficiently formed, and so the result would be contrary to what was intended. Instead of receiving the lofty rules, the individual who is burdened by them beyond his possibilities becomes rebellious against the law. This is not surprising, since life on a higher ethical level is impossible without basing oneself upon the grace of Christ, and this requires an active faith. Thus, an excessive zeal in the penalization of sins is damaging, as it may provoke angry social reaction, a turbatio. The same has to be said about an ostentatious demonstration of the faith that may irritate unbelievers. Since the second reason that is decisive for the picking out of those evils that are to be penalized is partly sociological and pertains to the art of government, and it is not directly ethical, it follows that politicians, also Catholic politicians, may have diverse views about their own society and about what is socially possible. They should therefore not be accused of error in the realm of ethics if they think that it is not expedient in a given moment to penalize a particular sin. It may be that they see other more demanding challenges with which the state has to deal, and so they may refrain from touching upon a volatile moral issue, even if some segment of their electorate may expect this. The attainment of a legal compromise that leaves some sins unpunished does not necessarily involve a moral compromise. If the politician assesses that a rigid penalization of a given sin will spark social upheavals, which he wants to avoid, he may refrain from the penalization. In such a case, however, he should not claim that I am personally against this evil act, but I think it's good for you. But he may declare this is an evil act, and yet politically and socially its penalization at present is not possible, if of course he has grounds to claim this in his own assessment. There remains also a further problem. Is the human law only to punish sins, or should it not also require virtuous action? Since today's states run many institutions, should they not demand virtuous action of their employees? The state expects the soldier or policeman to have fortitude, the teacher to be wise and honest, having the virtue of longanimity, and the doctor to be competent, generous, and humane. But is the state to ensure that people are sober or chaste? Searching for a solution to this problem, Aquinas distinguished between the private good and the common good that is the object of every virtue. Somebody may have fortitude in the defense of the state and may also have the virtue in the defense of personal rights and the rights of a friend. These are two different focuses that may be distinguished in the virtue. The state is primarily concerned only with the dimension of virtuous action that touches upon the common good and not the good of the individual. It orders the eliciting of only such acts of virtue that may be aligned to the common good, either directly or indirectly through social discipline, in which society is educated for the maintenance of peace and justice. Thus, the state may be focused on a wider spectrum of virtues, but always in reference to the common good, that is justice and social peace. It is not the task of the state to require of its citizens the individual dimension of virtuous acts. How is this distinction of Aquinas to be interpreted? Does the appearance of the distinction between the bonum privatum and the bonum commune allow for the relegation of morality to the sphere of private life, leaving to the law of the state only the role of social engineering, focused upon the public good as it is formulated by groups that have the clout and capacity to remind about their needs and values in public life? Such a conclusion cannot be drawn from the teaching of Aquinas. The bonum commune is not just the fruit of a social contract that is a compromise negotiated by some pressure groups in detachment from moral values. Aquinas doesn't allow for the restriction of morality to the sphere of the private conscience. Again, as Father Gilby writes, quote, "It is worth noting that the jurisprudence of St. Thomas, influenced more by the Greeks than the Romans, makes little play with the division between the private and public, and prefers the distinction, which is not quite the same, between personal and social, the monasticon and the politikon, the singulare and the comune, which represent not so much different spheres as different phases in and different abstractions from one single course of activity." End of quote. The common good is an objective reality that may be grasped in moral categories. Thus, the external dimension of an evil act may be recognized as it impinges upon the common good, that are the rights of others. Viewing the issue from a different angle, the state law is concerned about social justice, and if it covers the acts of other virtues or vices, this is uniquely due to the external dimension that ties with justice, and so it reacts to vices that violate public morality. Thus, the state forbids drunken driving, not in the name of sobriety, but in the name of justice. This distinction does not deprive the public life of a reference to morality, but at the same time, it defends against Puritanism. Father Lorenzo Perotto observed that in Article 3 of Question 96 of the Prima Seconda, quote, "is shown the nonsense of a state that would be accurately and specifically denominational. The virtues of individuals striving towards their good, even though in the supernatural perspective and also in the psychological and social, turn out to be beneficial for society, that they should not be regulated by the legislator because they do not enter in the realm of his specific task." End of quote. Thus, the human law, even if it does not punish all sins or impose all virtues, it does cover, in his view, the universal and social dimensions of every good that is grasped by all moral virtue and every evil that cuts down justice and social peace. Thus, the state is not to ensure that all people are sober and chaste. But if drug addiction, drunkenness, or social license will start to endanger the universal good of society, these issues will be a concern for state institutions. Steps that hopefully will limit demoralization are in the interest of society, and so they're undertaken in a prudent way and in accord with the tact of political art, is fully justified. The state, the existence of which derives from nature, cannot deny its dependence upon the natural law. Thus, the true source of state regulations is deeper than the current social situation, which often is viewed with axiological indifference. But it doesn't follow from this that the state, in a fundamentalist way, has to take on the task of a universal imposer of morality. In the 21st century even more, the extent of responsibility of states has grown enormously. States do not limit themselves to the judiciary and defense against a foreign enemy, as was the case in the Middle Ages. Today, government agencies cover wide fields of the economy, labor, education, the arts, health, and even sport and leisure. Bureaucrats and politicians who formulate the rules of work of these agencies often declare a liberal tolerance in respect to ethical systems. But having taken on such a wide field of responsibility, these agencies cannot escape from the necessity of discernment in basic moral issues. A reference to axiology is needed for the effective functioning of these state institutions. It is, of course, possible to try to abstract from philosophical ethical dilemmas, building the state not upon the natural law, but on the accepted social imaginary, without a basic moral order, about a basic moral order. The social imaginary about a basic moral order. This, however, may easily degrade to the level of fleeting moods of public opinion, often stimulated by vociferous minorities or by brute force. Such a state, then, deprived of a stable ethical reference, may have power, sometimes even of great might, but it will be a shaky house of cards in which there are no internal structures that hold a heavy society together. Therefore, the recognition of an objective, knowable moral order is something that states need for themselves, just as buildings need strong foundations. But in practice, we can observe that the greater the competence of the state with its entry into many fields of life, the lower is the ethos that it is capable of maintaining, let alone enforcing. Conclusion. The precise distinctions drawn from the teaching of Aquinas point to the need for ethical references in legislation, but they also defend against a too quick, ideologically moralizing attempt to directly condition the legal order in the name of ethical value. The state is to take into account the objective moral order, but it has its own tempo, its field of adaptation, its diversity, and specific tolerance. It doesn't prevent all citizens from committing sins, and it does not force all to be virtuous in every respect. But if the state requires the execution of evil acts, he who is faithful to Christ cannot approve such a situation. The state may not penalize some evil, but no one should be required to commit it. Aquinas insisted that when the state laws are directly contrary to the divine good, demanding, for example, idolatry, or are against the divine law, they are unjust, and so they are not to be followed, even at the price of losing one's job or martyrdom. But when the state laws are unjust because they are contrary to the human God, they are not binding in conscience unless the not following of them will cause scandal or social unrest. Thus, it is morally licit to accept that the state does not penalize some evil and even defend this impunity in defense of the social good. By showing in various ways the ethical horizon that has its basis in the natural law, and also by having her attention focused on the higher horizon of the law of grace, the Catholic Church contributes to the stability of the social order. The reference to nature and its requirements, that is metaphysical and not just sociological, does not convince all people, but it does give the grounds for dialogue with non-Christians. Lutherans who have dropped the searching for ethical orientation in nature, and the Orthodox who have a poor social ethics, may undertake this dialogue only in the realm of faith. Thus, in the ministry of ethical formation of political elites, the Catholic Church has an important role to play, having an impact on public life. But the Church is not Puritan, and she must not confuse the high ethos enabled by grace with the limited power of human law. It is the grace of Christ and not the state with its penal laws that leads to sanctity. Whether the Catholic lives under an atheist dictatorship or under an authoritarian regime that is hiding behind a supposedly Catholic ideology, thereby deforming faith and morals, or in a democratic state within a post-Christian society animated by an anthropology and public morality that are incompatible with the truth as it is known and taught by the Church, the true Catholic, knowing that he is a part of a hidden diaspora, has to continue to live the fullness of the Christian vocation and bring in the power of grace into those human relationships upon which he has some influence. Catholics, as they are employed in government agencies, may not commit moral evil, but they may try to ensure that their relationships and ways of dealing with issues are animated by gospel values. In this, they are to remember that the natural law, the Decalogue, and the laws of the state are not the only source of orientation. There is also the new law of the gospel, infused in the souls of those who believe in Christ. And that which is most powerful in this law is the grace of the Holy Spirit, which inspires and suggests how to react in given situations. Jesus told Peter to put away the sword of political power. But we need to believe that the Word of God, received in faith and in openness to grace, is like a double-edged sword that can slip into the soul and form thoughts, the will, and the emotion. It is not the states and their laws that lead to salvation, but the grace of Christ. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.